We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the third program of Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today's program examines curriculum, who determines the curriculum in the classroom, and who should determine the curriculum. We will be talking to four different guests, each with a different perspective on the issue. Our topic is particularly timely as we are currently in the midst of a hot debate about whether all of the states in our nation should agree to adopt a single set of standards for their schools and whether adopting a single set of standards will then lead to the implementation of a national curriculum. Our first guest is Judy Wigand, Assistant Superintendent for Achievement and Pupil Services in the Champaign Unit 4 District. She will be giving us the nitty-gritty of how curriculum is actually rather than theoretically developed in a particular school district. Welcome to our program, Judy. Can you tell us a little about your own background in terms of your interest in and knowledge about curriculum?
Well, I've been in public education over 25 years, and so I have been involved as a teacher, a classroom teacher, and my background is in actually special education. As well as regular education at the elementary level, and then have been working in a variety of different positions, whether it's as an associate principal, a high school principal, a curriculum director for a secondary level, and then I'm currently as an assistant superintendent, and I oversee different curricular areas. So, for example, right now I oversee K-12 English Language Arts, as well as the secondary career tech ed programs.
Who determines how many hours are devoted to particular subjects in high school?
Well, let me answer that, I guess, a couple different ways. One, we certainly have to meet the Illinois state code requirements of how many minutes are in a school day. And then we also have the local control when it comes to determining what will be our graduation requirements. And so when you have those type of two factors, really determines the courses that a student will need to take in order to, one, gain their diploma from a school, as well as then certainly making sure that they have a certain seat requirement when it comes to time during the school day.
Well, how do you determine your graduate requirements?
Right. That's determined by our Board of Education with input from the community, as well as what state national guidelines are for what they call maybe a highly qualified, what they're looking for in a graduate from our school system. So currently, for example, like No Child Left Behind would recommend that a student has at a minimum 4 years of English, I believe 4 years of math, 3 years of a lab science, I think 2 or 3 years of social science. And so, you know, you take a look at what is being called for nationally, and then, of course, a community states what they feel is important for their high school graduates.
Ah, okay. Now, who determines what novels, for example, are taught
mm-hmm.
in high school or middle school?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have actually a committee that works on approved readings. And so a lot of that work is done by our teachers who bring forward what they believe are good works of literature that will help support the curriculum. And that reading list then is brought forward to Central Office Administration and then receives approval so it can be on the approved reading list.
Okay, so that sounds as though it's very local.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It is.
And what about, is it the same process for historical figures or events taught mm-hmm. in social studies?
Mm-hmm. To some degree, although we do have, through the Illinois Code, certain things that have to be covered. And so that goes into our district policy, and then we have to make sure that those topics and subject areas are taught. I'm just going to reference, you know, some of our policy in our district regarding curriculum design and curriculum content. As you mentioned, like social science, for example, we we know that in, according to code, Illinois code, it says in all schools, United States history must be taught, including the principles of representative government, the Constitution of the U.S. and Illinois, the role of the U.S. in world affairs, the role of labor unions, and the role and contributions of ethnic groups, including the events related to the forceful removal and illegal deportation of Mexican-American U.S. citizens during the Great Depression. Further goes on to state, in additional schools shall hold an educational program on the United States Constitution on Constitution Day, which is September 17th. And so, again, the state, we have, there's a significant amount of local control, but still you have those statutes that you have to make sure that you're addressing that come from the state government. So that's just one example.
Huh. What about who chooses the texts, the textbooks?
That is done in our district, at least in Champaign. That is done through committee. And so if, for example, we are currently in our program evaluation or curriculum evaluation, we have a six-year cycle that we evaluate our curriculum. And we're currently doing our science curriculum. And so that team was headed up by our K-12 curriculum coordinator, and she had representatives, teacher representatives from all the different grade levels, as well as representatives from local colleges and universities. I know she had representatives from Parkland, which is our community college, as well as the University of Illinois, and as well as others in the field. And so they took, over the course of the last really 2 years, time evaluating what was currently taught, taking a look at national standards, state standards, as well as, you know, at this point, since Illinois has adopted the Common Core, taking a look at the Common Core standards. And then from that work, it drives what textbook would help support the delivery of the curriculum. And that recommendation is brought forward to, we have a district curriculum steering committee. That committee reviews that work, and then that proposal is brought forward to our Board of Education. And so the final approval would be the Board of Education.
Ah, okay. Well, what role does the student play, if any?
You know, actually very little. I guess when you ask that question, when I think of our different committees and so forth, certainly the role of the student when it comes to actually committee involvement, very little. But certainly we're always taking a look at how our students are performing and responding to the curriculum. And so if we say that these are our standards, but yet we have students who are struggling with those different standards, I mean, not necessarily a curriculum issue, it could be a pedagogy issue as well.
Ah, okay. You mean in terms of giving them individual instruction?
Right, the delivery of instruction, right.
Ah. What about the role of the individual teacher?
Certainly through their, they can participate in the different committees, whether it's building or district committee, to give input. And a lot of times when the curriculum teams are meeting to evaluate curriculum and determine textbooks and so forth, we conduct a lot of surveys. So that teachers, whether, you know, you have the time to commit to being on a committee, you can certainly still provide input through a survey.
If the committee chooses a list of novels, do all teachers or freshmen, for example, teach the same novel? Or can the individual teacher pick any book from the range of books picked by the committee?
They choose from a range that has been approved. So we have, a very wide range of novels that a teacher could select. And then if they have something that they feel would be that they would like to use in their classroom, there's certainly, again, we have a process where they can bring it forward and it can get obtain approval if it wasn't approved initially.
What about parents? Do they play any role?
Yeah, we have parent, I should mention that we do have parent participation, both when it comes to our curriculum evaluation process, as well as parent representation on our curriculum steering committee, which oversees the evaluation and anything new to the curriculum. So they have that opportunity, as well as public comment when the board is discussing the adoption of any new curriculum or textbooks.
Now, I can see also that in Champaign, the community definitely has had a role, because I know that in Champaign, the school district was under a consent decree for 10 years. I'll just describe to the listeners. A group of community activists and parents felt there was an equity problem in the district, and the school board and the community group agreed to a court-monitored process by which these concerns would be remedied. So then the question is, Did this agreement have any effect on the school curriculum in the classroom?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it did. And it continues to, actually. I mean, when you are in a community and you have a diverse community, you have an obligation to respond to the needs of all your students. And so I think it's important, and our district believes it's important, that when you're looking at the written curriculum and materials, do our students see themselves reflected in that written curriculum? And then, of course, when it comes to the delivery of the curriculum, are we responding to the needs of all our students, especially when you have, again, a diverse community, whether it's racially or ethnically diverse or even economically diverse, that it's important that, again, you're being responsive to the needs of your students.
Can you tell us more about the role of the school district's Board of Education?
Well, certainly, as the Board of Education is the governing body for a school district, they're going to have the final approval when it comes to what is taught, what are the requirements, and for high school graduation, for example, and they certainly take into account all the recommendations that come forward then from the central office. So they are key when it comes to setting our policy and procedures. So in Champaign Unit 4, we have a pretty extensive curriculum evaluation process, and that's actually in our policy book, and that guides our work. So I would have to say that they certainly play a key role when it comes to determining what is going to be taught, the length of school day, and all those different factors.
And now my question about the recently adopted nationwide Common Core standards. Are you pleased or displeased with them?
I actually, for myself personally and professionally, I am pleased that we have decided to go with the Common Core and for a variety of different reasons. But I do believe that it's going to provide increased level of rigor for all our students K-12 in focusing on those college and career readiness standards. And so I think what frustrates me, and I think my colleagues as well, is the level of direction and guidance being provided by our state as well as others when it comes to making the switch to the Common Core. We know that we're going to have a new assessment system in, I think, 2013-14. So, I mean, these years right now are critical to take a look at doing that gap analysis. How do our standards currently align to Common Core? Where are our holes? How can we, where do we need to make changes? Because, again, it's not just the written curriculum, but it's also how you deliver the curriculum. And those are just really critical things. And so I'm glad that we're moving and have adopted the Common Core, but also feeling a bit frustrated and a bit pressured to make sure that we are moving quickly enough in making changes in our program.
Thanks, Judy, for giving us such a concrete picture of the many factors an actual district takes into account when developing its curriculum. You're listening to Examining Education. We're considering the topic of who actually determines the curriculum in our public schools and who should determine it. We've been talking to Judy Wigand, Assistant Superintendent for Achievement and Pupil Services in the Champaign Unit 4 District. Our second guest is John Rudolph, Professor of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Wisconsin. Welcome to our program.
Well, Thanks. It's very nice to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own background in terms of your interest in and knowledge about curriculum?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I began my career as a high school science teacher, actually, and the spark of my interest in the curriculum as a subject of study, I think, began in a methods course that I had in my undergraduate teacher education program. There was an essay that my professor had the class read by Joseph Schwab, who was a scientist and educator at the University of Chicago, and he had written this in 1961 or 1962, The Teaching of Science as Inquiry. And in that essay, he advocated the use of history of science as a means of teaching science, or using original scientific papers for students to examine and learn from. And that sort of got me interested in the history of science and the history of that particular time period. This was in the later 80s when I had that class, and it was odd that this professor was having us read this essay from the 60s. But the 60s, it turned out, was this period of incredible curriculum ferment. And when I went to graduate school later on, it became the subject of much of my research.
What would you say have been the big ideas that have shaped curriculum development?
Over the past 150 years, I would say there have been two basic impulses or goals or philosophies. And on the one side, you have the desire to have school subjects or school curriculum reflect the knowledge of the field, the disciplines themselves. And this is sort of a humanist ideal that we want students to understand the best thinking that human civilization has developed over time and get students current in that thinking. And counter to that, though, on the other side, is this a functional idea, I think, where children should learn material that isn't the disciplinary knowledge that's out there, but rather things that are useful, that are directly relevant to their everyday lives. And I think this varies depending on who's writing that curriculum. What's relevant to someone in their personal life is different than what's relevant vocationally or socially or even politically and civically. And it's this tension between these things that has shaped much of curriculum over time, I think.
Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of how these goals have played out in the development of curriculum?
Yeah, absolutely. There's two. In my area, science education, you see this at different points in history. And with the rise of mass schooling in the 1800s, you had science introduced for the first time in the 1860s and 70s, and there was definitely an interest. I mean, the justification for including science. So the high school curriculum had typically focused on the classics, this humanistic approach to knowledge. And reformers wanted science in there because it was relevant, because it was useful knowledge. And so the schools had these courses in chemistry and physics and the sciences because these were for students who weren't going to college, because it was knowledge that they could use, the knowledge of plants to improve agriculture, chemical processes for industrial development, and things like that in the history of the United States. And then, though, there was this professionalization of science in the 1880s toward the latter part of the 19th century. And you had increasing influence from the new professional scientists who were coming back from studying in Germany, and they influenced the curriculum and refocused it on the disciplinary knowledge and introduced laboratory methods and had students learn this very, what came to be seen as esoteric scientific knowledge. And so this was one shift that you saw that occurred. And there was a backlash against this in the early part of the 20th century. There was a famous report, the Cardinal Principles Report of 1918, that came out and argued that the public should have, the school should promote knowledge that's interesting or useful in people's everyday lives. And that was another example that shifted it back toward the personal and social needs of the citizens. And it goes back and forth. After World War II, there was this re-emphasis on disciplinary knowledge because of the rise of science and its value in national defense, national security, and so people needed to understand science for those reasons. And so there's the tension over time back and forth between those two goals, I think.
Well, when you were a teacher in the classroom, for example, what did you think about when you were trying to determine what you were going to teach your students?
That's a great question. And it was a different time than it is now, I think, in the late 80s and early 90s. We had a lot of freedom. Teachers had a lot of freedom to pursue whatever curricular goals that they were interested in, more or less. I mean, there were guidelines and things like that. But what you decided to do was largely up to you as a teacher. And for me, I was influenced a lot by the history of science and thinking about science as a way of knowing, thinking about this humanist approach to understand the best that the scientists and these disciplinary ways of knowing have developed over time, and trying to communicate that to students so they would be able to think about how we know what we know and what's the basis for the knowledge that we have in science. So it was less focused on students' everyday needs, sort of consumer science and those kinds of things.
So now when you said you had some sort of guidelines, were they district or state or...?
The district guidelines those were never very useful. There would be exercises where the department, science department, would get together and they would say, we need to put together some guidelines. And typically teachers would get in committees and go through the textbooks and just lift out what the topics were of the textbooks that they used. And so in many ways, the textbooks themselves provided those guidelines. There were national guidelines. There were and right around 1989 is when Project 2061 got started, a curriculum project put forward by the American Association for the Advancement of Science that laid out these broad goals of what a scientifically literate citizen should know.
Then you're saying another powerful influence on the curriculum is professional associations.
Absolutely. For most of the past few decades, it's been professional associations have determined or guided. I mean, it always is in tension with there's the ideal that these associations put forth, like the National Science Education Standards by the National Academy of Sciences, which came out in the mid-90s, or the AAAS guidelines in Project 2061. And they're ambitious, and they're difficult to implement in the classroom. And so you have teachers trying to do those kinds of things, teaching using inquiry methods with these big ideas and themes, yet also relying on textbooks because they provide the on-the-ground structure for the curriculum that teachers can use.
Well, when you were teaching, who chose the textbook?
Those were typically done by a district textbook selection committee. I was part of that process when I was teaching biology. And there would be the group of biology teachers in the school district, along with a parent representative and perhaps a curriculum coordinator, a district curriculum coordinator or director.
You said that you think teachers have less autonomy today. How do the recently developed Common Core State Standards fit into our discussion?
Right. The Common Core Standards are a recent development, and they've been released in mathematics and English this past year, and in science they're still being reviewed and revised and refined. But what those, I expect that those are going to have a big influence. Their influence is going to come largely from the assessments that flow from those, though, I think, and that's another part of the sort of the structures shaping the curriculum that we need to keep in mind. It's not just the textbooks or the professional societies, but it's the whole movement towards accountability in this country that's driven a lot of what curriculum gets developed and what gets taught in classrooms. And so those assessment tools, will increasingly shape what goes on in classrooms. And the Common Core standards, I think, are going to be instrumental in driving the development of those assessments.
Do you think these new standards and assessments will improve our science instruction?
I'm skeptical myself about that. I think we're in a time period right now where we have this dual focus on standardization and accountability, and we're creating this system where the standards are aligned with the assessments, and that's aligned with the curriculum, and we want to get all those things on the same page so that what goes on in classrooms is accurately assessed, and that all of that reflects what these standards say students should know. And we may very well get wonderful increased achievement on these standardized assessments, but I don't know that the Common Core standards, for example, the draft copies that I've seen, represent the kind of knowledge and science that we necessarily should be focusing on. I mean, it's a start, but it goes back to that notion of it's focused on the content, knowledge, disciplinary knowledge in the sciences, with the hope that, or the belief, or the faith that this will, if students master this knowledge, that they will become proficient and technically skilled and contribute to the economic development and position themselves for the right kinds of new cutting-edge careers and all this. But this focus on vocationalism and global competition has this accountability at its base, and I don't, there's very little, that's all going on faith, there's very little research that would show that high levels of student achievement on those test scores is going to lead to the more general outcomes that policymakers are hoping for.
Thanks, John, for highlighting the many forces that historically and currently influence the curriculum. We've been talking with John Rudolph, Professor of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Wisconsin. I'm Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley, and this is Examining Education. Our third guest is Eugenia Kemble, Executive Director of the Albert Shanker Institute in Washington, D.C. Eugenia will be talking to us about why the Shanker Institute supports the Common Core State Standards and has issued a call for a common curriculum that supports these standards. Welcome, Eugenia, to our program. Let's begin by having you tell us a little about your own background in terms of your interest in and knowledge about curriculum.
Well, most of my involvement in this issue goes back to actually the first summits that were held by states on the need for standards. I think the first one was in 89 during the George W. H. Bush administration. And through the work of the Clinton administration, the next Bush administration, and right up until now, as you may know, in the early days there was a lot of discussion of the need for standards across the states, and a number of summits were held. They were sponsored by the states together with business. I guess IBM was a big leader. And one of the problems was when the Goals 2000 work of the Clinton administration came out asking states to develop standards, is that these standards were very uneven and they were very unspecific. When I headed the AFT's Educational Issues Department, we had a number of studies done called Making Standards Matter, which talked about the need for these standards to be improved. And then when I became executive director of the Shanker Institute, we actually started by co-sponsoring a conference with ACHIEVE on the need for professional development and curricula to be developed to match standards. And since then, as you know, the states joined together to develop the Common Core state standards in English language arts for social studies and science and in math, which are across the board for the states that have signed a very specific effort to develop common goals for standards. So that's a big plus. So I've been with this for over 20 years.
And what about the Albert Schenker Institute?
Well, the Albert Schenker Institute was created in 1998, and there was a tremendous amount of concern about standards then. We were doing polling of what teachers thought about standards. They were very positive, I think largely because they felt that standards would help develop equal opportunity for students. When a student went to third grade, you'd know something about what third grade meant, and it wouldn't mean fifth grade in one state and second grade in another state. And as I said, we reached out to a number of other groups to talk about how even if you had good standards, you wouldn't be able to implement them, which is one of the big issues today, if you didn't have curricula for teachers to use, all the materials, the guidance, the laying out of what could be done with respect to a standard, so that they could work in the classroom with kids, and that also those same teachers would need to have professional development to help them use that curricula. So that's how we got into it. It's been a long haul for us. We did put out a statement in March calling for curricula to match the Common Core state standards, and I would emphasize multiple curricula, not a single curricula.
Now, at the moment, they're basically English language arts and math. Are there going to be other standards for the social sciences and the sciences?
The concern right now is with getting the first set in place and developing assessments to match them, and as we hope, curricula as well. But yes, I believe that there will eventually be attention turned to these other subjects, because one of the things you don't want to have happened, as did happen with No Child Left Behind, is a focus strictly on two subjects, reading and math. You want kids to have a broad liberal arts curriculum, so I believe they will turn their attention to the other subjects.
Uh-huh. Well, what do you see as the strengths of the standards as they've been developed right now?
Well, one, they are more specific than many state standards. They inject a sequence for the learning of the subject matter, which is important. Textbooks don't do this. Textbooks tend to have everything under the sun in a book and don't really necessarily have a logical order that follows how students learn something. So in the case of math, for example, this has been very carefully crafted. And the concepts that kids would learn, the facts that they would learn, are laid out in a sequential order. They will need to be adapted to what a real state, what a real school year would look like in terms of the curriculum. And they're more specific. So I think they were developed by experts with input from teachers. There was a tremendously transparent process that went on. There were renditions of this that were put up on the web, and people were asked to comment. It took, while they did it pretty quickly, they were careful to consult with a lot of parties about it. And the fact that it was, they were sponsored by two state groups, the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers, means that the states were heavily involved in their development. So I think that's really important.
Well, what do you see as some of the weaknesses?
Well, for the standards themselves, I think they are just standards, and the weaknesses would fall more in whether or not they are implemented in a serious way, which is why we think you can't just say, here are the standards, and now we're going to assess students based on whether they've met these standards without providing the kinds of curricula and professional development that people will need at the state, district, classroom, school and classroom level. So I think the weakness is in if all of those that have come this far ignore how complex, difficult, and necessary it is to have a very, very sound implementation plan.
Well, doesn't that run into the national curriculum issue?
Well, You know, it's interesting. The critics of the Common Core state standards, I believe, are really setting up a straw man, or they're even in criticizing our statement. I mean, they say this is what they really mean, a national curriculum. This is the real agenda, the national curriculum. And nobody says that. And then they knock down that straw man, totally ignoring the fact that we're being very careful to say we're not for a national curriculum. You need multiple curricula. What you do need them all to do is make sure that there's mastery of the standards. So, I mean, I just basically think that's a huge mistake, and I don't quite understand why it's going on, because if we get good curricula to match these standards, we should be giving more kids equal opportunity. We should be enabling kids who are mobile and families who are mobile to know that when they go to, you know, grade 3 in Illinois, that they're going to get something similar to grade 3 in Mississippi and vice versa. So I see some of these as just mysterious, actually, and kind of political in a pretty simplistic way.
I know your website lists numbers of supporters who favor developing Common Core content to support the Common Core state standards. How would you describe the range of your supporters?
The support is very widespread. I mean, we have business, we have labor, we have Republicans, we have Democrats, we even have a former Surgeon General. It's just a huge group of people, and if you compare this to, I mean, I think there's some kind of a manifesto that's coming out today, to the kinds of supporters on that, you will see that there's quite a difference. I mean, let me give you some examples. We have Ernie Green. He was the first African-American who graduated from Little Rock High School, who went on to college. Richard Riley, former Secretary of Education. Edie Hirsch, founder and chairman of Core Knowledge. Susan Newman, she's now at the University of Michigan, former Assistant Secretary of K-12 Education under the last Bush administration. Kate Walsh, National Council on Teaching Quality. Tom Keene, former governor of New Jersey. He's a Republican. Yeah, Jocelyn Elders, 15th U.S. Surgeon General. Checker Finn, Fordham University. Louis Gerstner, he was the one that honchoed many of the, at least two of the state summits. He's the former CEO of IBM. So, I mean, you can see it's a pretty diverse group.
Does it give enough flexibility for teachers in the classroom when they have a variety of kids who are at different levels?
Well, having a variety of kids at different levels is going to be a problem. And I think that what this is going to show us, and we already know some of this from No Child Left Behind, is that those kids that don't have the foundation that they need to move on to a certain grade or to move into a grade, will need to get special attention to make sure that they've mastered the knowledge and skills that they need. And it may be that that all can't happen in a given classroom that is heterogeneously put together. It may be that these kids will need after-school efforts. They may need summer programs. They may need special tutors and mentoring. But that's what we want. We want to know what the kids need in relation to what they need to learn. So that's a big plus, but there's obviously going to be a lot of transition work that needs to be done to help these kids get up to speed.
And it sounds as though there's going to need to be a lot of professional development involved in this too, right?
Absolutely.
Right, right. Well, what are some key points you would like the audience to take away from this discussion?
Well, that we're really at a historic moment here in terms of these Common Core state standards. I think that if handled right, and so far I think they are being handled right, we have a chance to radically improve American education by developing an agenda that everybody will understand, not just teachers and schools, but students and parents, so that people can sort of hang in together on what needs to happen, what kids need to learn. And it's going to take attention not only to the setting of standards, but to the development of curriculum and to the professional development in the schools that teachers are going to need to teach to that curriculum. And as you've mentioned, the special sensitivities that are going to be required and programs to bring kids up to speed so they can function at the level that these standards demand.
Thank you so much for coming to the program and highlighting a really crucial issue for the audience. Thanks
again.
Thank
you, and it's good you hosted it. It's a very important issue.
We've been talking with Eugenia Kemble, Executive Director of the Albert Shanker Institute. For more information about the Common Core State Standards, go to our website, Examining Education, where you'll find links to the websites of the National Governors Association, the Council of Chief State Officers, and the Albert Shanker Institute. And this is Examining Education. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. And now our last guest, Sandra Stotsky, Professor of Education Reform and holder of the 21st Century Chair of Teacher Quality at the University of Arkansas. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little about your own background in terms of your interest in and knowledge about curriculum?
I would be happy to. My part of my background that relates to the question for this particular dialogue is the fact that I have taught both at the elementary and at the high school level, and I have done demonstration lessons at all grade levels, so I am familiar with the curriculum in reading and in literature and in English in general, English language arts, from K to 12. I also did work as Senior Associate Commissioner at the Massachusetts Department of Education from 1999 to 2003, where I was in charge of the revision or development of K-12 standards in all major subjects. I know a great deal about history, music, and I know all the issues involved in the curriculum for science and math, even though I am not a mathematician or a scientist. So my background in understanding curriculum and curriculum development is extensive. I've also was in charge of teacher tests, teacher licensure regulations, professional development for teachers, and anything else with an academic component, and I've done a lot of research on teacher education. That's probably enough at this point to indicate my understanding of curriculum.
What do you think should be the main factors that should be taken into account when developing a curriculum?
When schools develop a curriculum, or is that the level at which we're talking, since I do not think that state departments or of education or federal departments of education should be developing curricula, because curriculum and instruction have always been matters of local control and interest. So when local schools develop a curriculum, they need to take into account several different aspects of what a curriculum should cover. First of all, they need to think about what they want anyone graduating from grade 12 and receiving a high school diploma to be able to do, to know and be able to do, because at that point, around the age of 18, they can be voting citizens. Then there is the question of what curriculum should be in place for students who are fast learners and may have intentions about going to college, not everyone wants to go to college, not on everyone will go to college, but there should be some components of a curriculum that address the needs of those learners with ambitions for serious academic study. And then there need to be alternative kinds of curricula, just as respectable and dignified, for those students who, like many of my own relatives, liked working with their hands and were very oriented towards other kinds of trades, occupations, were not terribly interested in serious academic studies beyond high school, but were very interested in other kinds of work that our society, unfortunately, doesn't seem to value as much as it should be.
What people should be involved?
There should be a variety of people. You would want literate, educated parents in the community because it's their children who are going to be in the schools. You would want to find out from local businesses and industries what their needs are, because that would be one of the greatest strengths we could have if we offered the kind of high school programs that most other countries offer. They involve local industry and business in working out occupational programs at the high school level that may lead to apprenticeships or to work being hired in these industries. But in any event, you need the input from local business and industry as well as parents. Then you would also ask people at the college level what they think the end point should be. Obviously, there are a lot of differences between grade 1 and grade 11, and you need to have experienced teachers who can give you an indication based on their experience of what are reasonable expectations at each grade level in each subject area, and to make sure that your teachers are knowledgeable about the subject that they are informing the curriculum development people about.
So then, what do you think about, since you're speaking mostly locally, what do you think about the need for national standards?
I do not think national standards in this country are justifiable. If this were a tiny little state or an area of the country that was a little more homogeneous than this entire country is, that would be different. But a huge country like this, I don't think, justifies having one set of standards at the national level.
It's clear that you favor local control and oppose national standards. I noticed that you were one of the people who signed the counter-manifesto that just came out on May 6th. It argues against the Albert Shanker Institute manifesto. For our listeners, let me explain that the Shanker manifesto proposes developing a Common Core curriculum to support the Common Core state standards. Can you tell us more about this counter-manifesto?
It's a document that is to which a lot of people have written their names for, subscribed, that expresses their concern about an effort to centralize and nationalize major educational decisions, not only what the so-called standards are, but also what the curriculum would be to go with these standards. It's a one-size-fits-all kind of set of standards, and the fear is that it would also be a one-size-fits-all curriculum, which makes no sense, as I say, in a country this size, particularly when we know most other countries have optional high school curricula for their students, which is far more reasonable, appealing, and helps to curb the dropout. To me, there's a lack of vision in what is happening, and the manifesto, the counter-manifesto, was an attempt to point out that there are a number of problems with what the U.S. government is doing and what the Gates Foundation is doing in supporting all of this behind the scenes, particularly. One of my great civic concerns has been the lack of transparency in everything that has gone on, because that has always been one of my major interests and issues. I have been very active in civic life.
So
League of Women Voters, library trustee, town meeting member, many, many other committees, as well as the State Board of Education in Massachusetts. I understand civic procedures, and
right.
Common Core didn't follow any of them. I don't want things developed behind the scenes. If the federal government wants to be allied with a group like CCSSO that is developing so-called first-rate standards that should have been internationally benchmarked, it then offers them to the states, but it doesn't tie it to Race to the Top money, which then says you'll get money if you adopt.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's strong-arming.
Ah, well, but last thing is what are some key points you want the audience to take away from this discussion?
One of the first points is that we need to avoid a one-size-fits-all curriculum that goes from 6 to 12. I have no problem with a K through 5 curriculum in terms of the kind of knowledge we would want as a baseline for students. I've always supported core knowledge for that reason. But once we go to the secondary level, 6 to 12, we must, in this country, start providing alternative high school curricula that students can choose by the time they're in middle school. This is the only thing that makes sense in a country this diverse. They must all have core subjects that they take, English, history, math, and science. But how they are folded in, exactly how they're treated in the context of these different high school options, should be something that is left to the state and local level, not decided by a central bureaucracy.
Ah, well, on that note, I think we'll end our discussion. And thank you very much for agreeing to be on the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You have been listening to Program 3 of our series Examining Education. Our topic today was school curriculum, who currently determines school curriculum, and who should determine it. I invite our listeners to go to our website, examiningeducation.org, or to our Facebook page, Examining Education, to send us your comments about today's program. Listeners who want to explore this topic further will find additional details and links on our website. Our next program will be on teacher evaluation. How much are teachers responsible for student achievement, and what is the best way to measure their effectiveness? We encourage you to send in your suggestions for future topics and for future speakers. Today's program was produced with audio help from Mike Pritchard and Jason Croft. I am your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley.